Welcome to our Bible study on the book of Exodus, chapter 17, verses 1 through 7. I will assume that you have read the passage, that you have your Bible before you, and that you understand our translations may not always agree. Our passage is the second of three accounts of murmuring by the Israelites of thirst as they journey in the wilderness going to the promised land. Some scholars suggest that all three accounts may be based on a single occurrence, so we will quickly review them here. In the first account, chapter 15, verses 22 through 27, we have an account where the people complain against Moses because the water is bitter. The Hebrew word is mara, bitterness. And Moses cried to the Lord, who showed him a tree. And he threw it into the water, and it became sweet. In this account, the Lord healed the water, and Israel is challenged and reminded that if they will stay faithful and obedient, then God will not put the diseases on them that God did do to the Egyptians, because God is their healer. So there is a miraculous provision of water for the people. But the way it happens is quite different from our passage. The third account is in Numbers chapter 20, verses 1 through 13, and cites Moses' own lack of faith, where instead of speaking to the rock, Moses strikes the rock twice, and although water comes forth, it also results in Moses not being allowed to enter into the promised land. In this account, we see a lot more similarity to our account. There is a miraculous provision of water for the people, but Moses has shown either a lack of faith or rebelliousness by not completely obeying God. Our passage today immediately follows the account of the manna in chapter 16, verse 1, and it precedes the defeat of Amalek in chapter 17, verses 8 through 16, in which the people of Israel are victorious through the miraculous intervention of Moses keeping his arms up. All of these stories are linked on the chain of the wilderness itinerary by the listing of stopping places along the way. And all this itinerary has the appearance of precision. It is impossible to reconstruct an actual route of the travels from Egypt to Canaan. Our passage presents the two major themes of the wilderness tradition. On the one hand, there was the almost continual grumbling and complaining of the people. In chapter 14, verses 10 through 12, they complained out of fear because the Egyptians pursued them to the edge of the sea. As we just saw in chapter 15, verse 22 through 27, they complained for lack of clean water. In chapter 16, verses 2 through 3, they complained because they were hungry. And then in Numbers, chapter 11, 4 through 9, after feasting on manna for years, they complained that their diet was boring. And now, in our passage, they are complaining about a lack of water. On the other hand, the time in the wilderness was also remembered as a time when God graciously and miraculously provided care for the people. When the people were needy, God provided manna, quails, and water. Were the people's complaints legitimate or not? The story of the manna in Exodus chapter 16 made it clear that the complaints were unnecessary grumbling. But our passage, well, we will have to wait and see. In verse 1, we are told that the Israelites moved on from the wilderness of Sin. But that Hebrew word has absolutely nothing to do with our English word for sin, as cool as that would be. I mean, you could hear the sermons now, how when we are in the wilderness of sin, we are rebellious to God and on and on. But that's not what the Hebrew word means. The wilderness of sin is not exactly known today, but it is not the same as the wilderness of Zin, which is mentioned elsewhere in the Bible. Although the wilderness of Zin may be related to Sinai. The route of the Israelites from Egypt places the wilderness of Zin somewhere between Elam and Sinai, and continues with places like Rephidim and Dophka and Alush. None of those places can be located with certainty today, although some scholars think that the biblical Dophka is to be identified with the turquoise mines at Serabit al-Qadim and the Sinai Peninsula. It is possible that the events described in today's lesson occurred somewhere near the western foot of the Sinai Massive. We are also told they camped at Rephidim, but that location is not known with any certainty. It should probably be sought in the general direction of Kadesh, which you can hear about in Numbers chapter 20, verse 1, near which Mount Horeb must also be looked for. The Amalekites, in verse 8, lived in this Negev area, and not at the lower end of the peninsula, where the old Sinai tradition was thought to be. As we see in verse 1, the Israelites find themselves at a place without water. Not unusual in the desert. Small wonder, then, that they should complain because of thirst. And God grants the request and provides water, and so acknowledges the need. But the complaint is seen to go far beyond the need of water. As in most other cases, the people blame Moses for their problems. And as we see in verse 2, they question his leadership, complaining in essence of his ineffectiveness and incompetence. And if we skip ahead to verse 7, we see that the people's contentiousness is emphasized in the names of the place of the miracle. And as we also see in verse 7, the complaint amounts to the denial of the presence of God with the people. Continuing back to verse 2, Moses in essence is saying, "Why blame me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" Now that Hebrew word for test is natnesa, which means to see if one will act in a certain way. And that is a better reading than the King James version of to tempt, which can have the meaning of trying to provoke a person to act in a certain way. And we expect Moses to say, as he did back in the manna incident in chapter 16, 7 and 8, to say, "He is innocent, and their grievance should be addressed against God instead of him." But as we see in verse 3, the people clearly are holding Moses responsible. They are accusing Moses for causing death by instigating the Exodus. And in verse 4, Moses does not cry out for the well-being of the people, but for his own safety. He cries out to God so that he won't be assaulted. In verse 5, God answers, but God does not address the problem of Moses' leadership or even his safety. Instead, God directly addresses the people's problem of thirst. God instructs Moses to take his rod, which embodies Moses' authority from God, and by which he instituted the first plague, by striking the Nile and turning it to blood, back in chapter 7, verse 17, and in verse 20. And as we get to verse 6, we see the center of God's response is in God's own commitment to the process. "Behold, I will stand before you," assuring Moses of God's presence. Clearly, this is a striking attribution of human characteristics or behavior to God. And in fact, in the Mikilta, a Jewish teaching on Exodus and other works, offers the following interpretation of this. God said to him, meaning Moses, "Where you find the mark of a man's feet, there am I before thee." Some scholars suggest that the reference appears to be to a particular rock on Mount Horeb, which is how Josephus in Antiquities 3:1.7 interpreted it. Some, however, point to the Jewish Aramaic translation of the Torah, the Targum Onkelos, on Numbers 21:17, which reports that the rock Moses struck thereafter followed Israel on its pilgrimage to provide it with water. And from there they continued to Beer, and that is the well of which the Lord said to Moses, "Gather the people together, and I will give them water." In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, Paul reveals his knowledge of this legend and seems to take it seriously. "And all drank the same supernatural drink, for they drank from the supernatural rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ." In verse 7, we are given an unexpected twist. We might expect the conclusion to be a celebration of amazement in the life-giving wonder and miracle brought by God. But instead, the focus is on two verbs that concern the action of the people. Test, here named Massa, also what we talked about earlier is Nasa, both times, and Meribah. Technically, the Hebrew word is rib. It means quarrel. The story is presented as a story of unfaith. The idea is not that God must demonstrate a capacity for giving life. That is assumed. What is exhibited is not the power of God, but Israel's inappropriate and remarkable lack of faith. In the context of the Exodus and the wonders already displayed, Israel should have known and trusted. Instead, Israel is remarkably stubborn and arrogant. Israel dares to ask a demanding question that presumes on God. Sometimes the complaining of the people is interpreted as being the reason God punished the people of that generation, except for Joshua and Caleb, by not letting them into the promised land. But in our passage, God does not reprimand or threaten those who are complaining so bitterly. With Moses as the agent, God acts to meet the need, so that some see in this story how God will not let the unfaith of the Israelites frustrate God's fulfillment of the promise made to make of Abraham's descendants a great nation in their own land. Seen in this way, the story, some interpret the story as being a parable of God's patient grace. Grace comes here through miraculous means, but its form is as simple as it is essential: life-sustaining water.